Exploring the importance of having the right skills to succeed. This is Skillfully Speaking, supported by Babcock International. Presented by Skills Ambassador Jackie Grubb.
Welcome to Skillfully Speaking. I'm Jackie Grubb and I'm delighted to welcome Rob Rinder, renowned barrister, TV personality and advocate for justice and equality. From the courtroom to Judge Rinder, Rob has mastered skills in communication, resilience and personal growth. Let's explore the lessons behind his fascinating journey. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. So you're in Plymouth.
Which is lovely. And it's a part of the world that I have hardly been to. What I'm delighting in is how down here in the lovely bottom end of Britain, there's such a wonderful microclimate of loveliness. You know, what's so nice when you meet people from Plymouth, they never tell you where they are or what their lives are like or what the city's like based on how far away it is from London. Whereas there's other parts of our shared country where you say, oh, it's here, and they say, oh, it's only so far from London. People really enjoy and are proud of the city and of the region, which I think is wonderful.
And it's such a beautiful day. Mm. I've already been for a sea swim this morning on our beautiful coastline.
Well, you didn't invite me, but that's because I got up a little bit late. But had you have done, I would have been with you.
Well, perhaps we'll do it over the Christmas holidays.
Cold swimming
that's
is extremely
amazing.
Important.
Well, I've got lots of questions to ask you today, and our listeners, I know, will benefit from the advice and the feedback that you give. And actually, what drew you to pursue a career in law, and how did you identify the skills that you needed in such a demanding field?
Well, here's the thing. Things have changed considerably in terms of skills, in terms of the skills you need, in terms of the hoop jumping that you need to do. When I became a barrister, I didn't have a game plan. And nowadays, as somebody that's still a member of Chambers and will sift through the applications, of which there are many, and to go to the end of the story very quickly, we have about 300 applications. We may take 2 pupils a year, right? So that's how competitive it is. Looking through those wonderful buffet of human experience in the applications, there is hardly a single person, I suspect none, who has approached it the way I did. Because, first of all, when I went to university, it was free. And so you could explore more broadly. Nowadays, you really do have to have intent and, above all else, understand the skills you need to develop and the experience that you need to populate your application. In other words, all of the work experience, the life experience, in order to really reflect and think about whether or not you're going to go down the route of law. Whereas I absolutely didn't. I was really interested in drama and things, firstly, well, when I was much younger. And then when I went to Sixth Form College, a further education college, I found my inspirational teacher. I think that can make the essential difference. And in my case, Mrs. Grice, and she has shaped and changed the lives of so many, not just me. And I've met them in the halls of Westminster and at the BBC and various other places. She, I suppose, turned on the switch of me loving learning. And that was the most important thing. This thirst to want to explore academic things on my own. And above all else, she had this sort of belief, which we all need to have. Some have it innately. But that sense of empowerment we feel when somebody who we admire says, you know, you're quite clever. And I was sort of 15. And up until that point, I'd been a fairly average student. I suspect my teachers from my secondary school would say other things, more than fairly average. They would say probably less than average. She, I suppose, gave me the sense of belief that actually I really could and should be interested in exploring the world of the mind. And so I became a sort of voracious reader, and at that point decided I was going to go to university and study politics and modern history. But that was it. I had no game plan beyond that at all. And whilst I was there, I stopped acting, not on purpose, I should add. I'd stopped acting for some years because of my interest in all of these academic things. But I thought I'd give it a go. And then on the first day of university, I went to audition for a role, thinking, you know, I'd give it a go. It might be a nice thing to do in my spare time. I read the part, and the director, who's now a very well-known director, looked at me thinking, oh, this is rather good, you can tell. And then the next person got up and read the part. And I thought, wow, that sounds totally extraordinary. Almost like the molecules of the room have shifted in some way. I could do this, but I don't think I'd ever reach the zenith of that brilliance. And that person who was acting was Benedict Cumberbatch, and we became best friends at that point. Yeah, so I really carried on down the journey, let's say, of academic pursuits and loved it. And then also got involved in debating at university, which is enormously important for people who are considering law. Exploring ideas, challenging yourself to think about the alternative argument very quickly, shaping and framing a case within 5 minutes, let's say, being able to deliver that with confidence to a room full of people, being able to answer really challenging questions from the other side in a short period of time, and having above all else the confidence to be an advocate, to shape, to sell a narrative and an idea to a community of people. And that was sort of like a university sport. And we got quite good at it, my debating partner and I, who's now in America and runs an extraordinarily successful law firm there. Anyway, because I did debating, apologies for the long-winded story, I realized after a time that we were debating against a lot of lawyers, including people from Inner Temple and the various inns of court who were allowed their own university teams. And what happened was a natural progression from being, well, from leaving university was, well, if you're good at debating, you go and become a barrister. So I didn't have any particular social mission at that point. This often surprises people now who are applying to become barristers. It's unthinkable. I hadn't been to court before. I certainly had strong views and opinions about the world, but they didn't shape or influence my decision to become a barrister. It was just the natural next thing. And I loved university, and without that debating, probably would have gone on to perhaps become an academic or something. I did really well, not because I was thirsty to get a first. That didn't matter. It wasn't about that. It never is to do well in a way that matters. It was because I loved learning and I loved the subject. And again, that word, it mattered to understand it fully and to engage with the work. And that's what gifted me a wonderful university experience. And then I went and did a law conversion and applied to Chambers and managed to get a pupillage. But I got a pupillage not because of any work experience. I mean, I'd done some work experience, again, because of this privilege. I hope we're going to come back to that word, where I had a couple of connections where I could go and do what's called a mini pupillage. So I could get to go to Chambers and friends of friends who allowed me a week to watch what was going on. So that was down on my application. But it's really because in the interviews, the first one is a general meeting and sometimes they liked me, sometimes they didn't. But in the second round of the interview, even though I'd never seen any court at this point, they'd asked me to do what's called a plea in mitigation. That means where your client has been convicted and you have to try and persuade the judge to give your client a lower sentence. Well, I looked at what was asked of you in that situation, and really it was just like being a debater. I was persuading the judge to listen to my case, which I'd done for a long period of time because of the intervarsity, this competitive debating that I'd been involved in. And that's how I got the pupillage. But at the time I started on that first day with all that competitiveness and that 200 and they took two of us, I still hadn't really ever seen a court case. Which is quite extraordinary.
That is so inspirational. I have such a passion for lifelong learning. So wherever you are, you always learn something from everybody, really, whether that is an academic qualification or just people skills. It's so inspiring that there's hope around role models and ambassadors and people that you come across in your life that believe in you. And I hear so many stories about how people have moved through life because people have given hope and belief.
Sometimes people feel contained, conscripted into what we now loosely know, and perhaps some of your younger learners will be aware of, lanes, stay in your lane.
Yeah.
Or a narrative that's been written for them because of family, because of the community you're in. And actually the most important lesson, I think, in life, and one that my grandfather, who was a Holocaust survivor, really taught me more than anything else, is this wonderful Yiddish word that applies to everybody. The word is dovka. And what it means is being contrarian. I don't mean silly contrarian, the type of person we all have them in our friendship groups. Well, not our friendship groups, certainly in our family. We're recording it around Christmas. You'll know who they are. They get annoying around the time of Boxing Day. No, you say the sky is blue, the sky is green, just to be contrarian. No, I mean grabbing back the pen. So when a story's been written for you, where they've told you what the outcome of your life's journey is, you hold that pen and you have the power to write your own chapters. And that's the most important thing, dovka, being contrarian. And that, of course, means thinking about how, if you have a passion, if you have an impulse, go and learn something. If you have even the germ of an idea that you'd like to be this person or explore this idea or have a go at this thing, you have the gift to be able to do it. All you need to do is take that first step and remember that you hold the pen. And that's true of everything we do in life. And it's why lifelong learning is so profoundly essential. You describe me as going from the courtroom to Judge Rinder, but actually the most wonderful things that I've been privileged to do over the past years, certainly the last 5 years, are the various documentaries I've made alongside brilliant communities, learning to conduct and conducting, as some of you might have seen with Rylan in Venice, learning and exploring the arts as I do, wanting to share. And again, I overuse words because when I think they're important, but empower people, which I really care about, to think that whether it's opera or art galleries, everything is for them. And that's really what I've enjoyed doing. And I continue to learn all the time from every encounter I have, which is so wonderful.
It is. Rob, you've got such a beautiful persona. Is that natural to you? Or we talked before we came on air about essential skills.
Well, we should talk about essential skills. And we should give your listeners an exclusive, because one of the essential skills is showing up on time, which I do religiously. And this morning you encountered a first because I didn't. So I was a little bit late. So I might have a nice persona, but let's not give your listeners the idea that I'm perfect.
Well, Rob, I don't think anybody is perfect.
Far
you know,
from it.
We're human beings at the end of the day, aren't we?
Yeah.
What are those other essential skills? So you've talked about turning up on time,
Right. Making
sure that things are in your diary.
Mm-hmm.
But what about those things in terms of resilience or maybe teamwork? Because law, if we go back to the law thread,
Yeah. That's
black and white, isn't it?
No, gosh,
no.
Not black and white. There are essential skills, to be sure. But don't forget, in law, there is such a variety, such a rich buffet of different kinds of law, which requires different personality types to be involved in them. People think of law and they immediately think of courtcraft, or they think of barristers on telly and the type of things that you might see in courtroom drama. But there are so many different fields. So if you're going to, for example, be involved in intellectual property work, which sounds very trite, but it can be fascinating. So, for example, who owns the right to a trademark? People think that that doesn't apply to them. And then I often go and speak to young learners in schools, and they create content on TikTok or on Instagram. And they even make their own T-shirts. And I say, great, somebody wants to sell it. Who owns it? Now, that law is very challenging and very technical. And you might be technically minded, and you might be scientifically interested, let's say, or inclined. And that's more useful as a buffet of skills to be thinking about doing that kind of law. Again, if you're interested in being a commercial litigator, business acumen is often more important than being somebody like me who's more interested in thinking about how to be an advocate and persuading a jury. So there's a vast range of different skills that are useful to law, depending on the type of law that you want to do. But at the heart of law, the thing that, if you think about, I'm sure some of your listeners will know what Venn diagrams are. Those are little circles, and the thing that's in the middle that overlaps them all. So what are the central skills, I guess, or demands if you're going to be a lawyer? And I guess there are four things. The first one is judgment. And here's the thing, judgment has nothing to do with book reading at all. It's all about this very overused word, and I'm afraid to say, very undervalued common sense. And that comes from life. It comes from making mistakes and learning from them. And again, I always come back to Yiddish because it's a universe of explanation and definition in only one phrase, sechel, that instinctive sense that you get it, just judgment. So for example, in criminal law, it's not about the questions that you ask somebody. I mean, you'll have an idea. So if you come into a case, you'll often have what's called a case theory. So bear in mind, in a criminal trial, reasonable doubt is what matters. So if you're defending somebody, the jury have to be sure. Well, if you're defending someone, your job is to look at the evidence and determine how a jury might take a view that they're not sure. Well, that's just looking at the evidence in a common sense way. So we're still on point one. I'll give you an example of how this is really interesting in when we interview people for pupillage, which is the bit or the phase, very challenging phase I was talking about before you become a barrister. We often have brilliant people who, I say brilliant people, academically brilliant, who have done really extraordinary things, PhDs, etc. And they might get through to the first round. And in the second round, what happens is they'll come to chambers. And this is, I should emphasize, years ago when I used to sit on this panel, but it hasn't changed significantly. And they'll be given a tranche of material, and it'll be about a GBH, in other words, a fight that's taken place where somebody's been significantly injured. And they've got an hour to go away and prepare the case and open it to the jury for the prosecution. And they have to come in and do that in front of seven of the most well-known, famous lawyers in the country, right? And often it isn't, if not always, I should say, the people with the most stellar academic backgrounds that can do that. They'll often come in and start talking about the vehicle in the public house, and I'm scratching my head going, what? And of course, it's a pub fight. What happened? What color was the door? So the first thing is common sense. Second is communication. And that, if you like, segues from that point. So can I communicate a challenging idea to you in a way that's relatable, in a way that's clear, in a way that has an element of passion, perhaps, but above all else, enables you to understand what I'm talking about. And so you walk away feeling that you've been perhaps educated, empowered. So communication is really important. Third thing is resilience. And we talked about that. And there's different kinds of resilience.
It's a buzzword, isn't it?
But it's blooming tough. And so how do you manage rejection? How do you cope with the inevitable likelihood of failure? And how do you sit with the idea that failure isn't a bad thing? In fact, that's the stuff that builds the muscle and the sinew to make you carry on and go forward. Whether that's failing to get pupillage or perhaps failing an exam, how do you look at that in an emotionally literate way? Again, that fourth skill I'm going to come on to next, where you think, right, how do I take that failure and turn it into an opportunity to learn moving forward, as opposed to sitting in bleakness? And that can be challenging. And the last one is emotional literacy. Now, this is a challenging one because I'm sure you will have thought about this infinitely more deeply than I am now and have thought about it. But one does wonder whether or not you can teach that. I think you can. And I think what that means is learning about the room, thinking about, well, how do I make an impact in this space? My judgment, coming back to those skills, about the questions that I don't ask in a case. I was about to come onto that. When you're formulating a case, it's not often about the questions you ask. It's about the silly question you didn't ask. It's more important, especially important in a criminal case. But that emotional literacy is so undervalued, so hard to evaluate, but we know it when we see it. And it has such currency in every job you do, whether you're in the medical field, whether you're communicating with colleagues and team members in engineering, whatever you do, being a presence in the room that enables people to feel better about their job, to feel empowered, and for you to think about how you are in a space with your colleagues in a room has such value, I think, and it's enormously important.
I can so resonate to that. And that is going to be just such amazing advice for anybody. And I just wanted to sort of explore a little bit more about the debate, because you've already mentioned and alluded to debating in different scenarios. And some people find it difficult to have a difficult conversation or explore certain themes of life without taking it too far. So what skills do you think that people would need, or what would you advise in terms of whether it's a debate or whether just it's a constructive conversation for every walk of life?
Well, there are two types. If you're debating and we are now sitting having a debate, yeah, and it's structured as that and announced as that and the space is created for a debate, that's one thing. If you're having a conversation with a colleague and it's about a challenging or delicate issue, that requires, again, we come back to emotional intelligence, a different skill set and a different approach. So let's take the first one. We are having a debate. The most important thing is we never attack people. We attack ideas. And the value of that is absolutely sacred. It's the stuff that we fought for. And the most important thing is, how do we structure a point so that we influence and shape how people are going to listen to us? And nowadays, that's extremely difficult. And I teach essay writing sometimes to students. And, you know, there's a standard thing where we make a point and we have our example. And at the end, we say, therefore, this is what it means. There's three elements. Well, there's three elements to making a point. And there's one element to making a good debate. The first one is structure. And I can't emphasize how important this is. Now, here when we're talking, we're kind of free-flowing. But if I were giving a lecture, I was like, right, I'm going to talk about this, A, B, C, D, and E. Now, immediately that makes people listen and they can write down anything that they want to take from it. But above all else, they feel like it's contained and shaped in some way. And if you've only got an hour or 5 minutes even, everybody knows precisely where you're going and they're listening out for it. And it means they've ticked off those little things they've taken away. Second thing is, how do you make a constructive point? And this applies to a debate just as much as the next thing I hope we're going to talk about, which is how you have these challenging conversations outside of that situation and space. And increasingly, that's become very difficult because people, especially in the most challenging and, let's say, fraught issues of the day, those things are often very personal. How you feel about various issues sits in the part of your brain where your identity is, where the emotional hemisphere rests. And so you might hold a deeply strong belief about the world. And if I say, well, I don't agree with you, that can feel, I emphasize that word, it can feel like an attack. It can feel like somehow somebody's undermining your moral view of the world. That could be because you have a different view about international affairs, for example. You think about what's happening in our shared world at the moment. And so if that's the case, we can't have a conversation because you feel, well, I'm under attack here, or you're a bad person for holding those views. And that means that conversation and debate becomes impossible. So in the work that I do as an advocate and also making documentaries, there are three elements. The first one is to do the hard work of saying, I hear you. And that's really important even in a debate. I hear what you say. That can be very difficult when somebody said something challenging or you think it's so morally wrong that it challenges the idea that the person sitting opposite you is a good person, even though you might agree with 90% of what they say otherwise. So I hear you. Secondly, here's a fact. Now, facts matter. But nowadays, we live in a world where there's a competing force, there's a competing impulse for facts. Reality is there are facts, but that's not going to land. If I tell you a fact about an international issue that, let's say, you've got a strong view on, it'll just bounce off. So I hear you. Here's the fact. This happened on such and such a date. Well, you'll have your own set of facts. What's the third element of the point then? Is let me tell you a story. So I hear you. Here are some facts. Here's a person I'd like to tell you about. Now, you can do that in documentary making. You can even do that in a debate. And that's not necessarily going to fully change the mind of the person sitting opposite you. They're not going to have, as we would understand it biblically, a road to Damascus moment going, oh, you're so right, I was wrong about everything. Yeah. But what we can do in conversation and debate, both as I say, in the competitive realm where we're trying to argue our case, or when we're having conversations with colleagues, that second situation, is to help people walk away thinking, goodness, that's complex. That's it. Not maybe I was wrong, because that's a very challenging thing to do, but that involves ego and it's very difficult to unpick that. But that second situation where you have a difficult, perhaps even toxic work environment, or one where things are very difficult and you need to bring something up, doing active listening or having difficult conversations requires precisely the same process of calmly hearing. As my mum would say, God gave us two ears and one gob for a reason. Secondly, to say, well, actually, the facts as I understand them are these. You might not agree, but come armed with an example. And I don't expect you to be changed anyway, but, or I'd like you to watch this. That's all. And thank you at the end. And as long as you approach those situations with that degree of what we now understand as mindfulness and humanity, generally speaking, what happens is we don't necessarily change each other's minds, but you acknowledge each other's humanity, and it empowers you to have the next conversation and the next. And that, I think, is enormously important.
Gratitude and thanks are just so important, aren't they? And they are just so simple. And, you know,
I'm not sure they're simple. Well, they're very difficult. I think we forget to do that all the time.
Yeah. I suppose being a yogi, I think it is simple, but perhaps it's not simple to the outside world, is it?
That's true. Gratitude is such an important element.
Yeah.
Wherever or whatever our privilege is, even if we think we have none. I mean, it's a different conversation to some extent from the one we're having now, but waking up in the morning and thinking, what am I grateful for? Has an enormously, again, we keep talking about this word, but skills and empowerment are so interchangeable as words, can be so empowering. Think, right, what have I got this morning that I can do? What can I tick off a list? And I'm grateful for having been able to do that. That's a wonderful thing and a wonderful method of approaching the world.
Yeah, and there's always something to be grateful for. Mm. The planet is just so hungry for change, isn't it, at the moment? And a lot of people's worlds are so fragile. So leading on to what we've discussed already, mediation is quite a big thing. And I think in leadership or a skill for everybody to be able to be supported with, mediation is quite a big thing, I think. But in terms of your world, mediation is something that you're really good at in terms of your line of business, aren't you?
Well, mediation is nowadays in law, not just important, in lots of fields, it's a requirement.
Yeah.
Especially, for example, in family law, where everything is done to avoid getting people to court because it's expensive and because it ends up in a toxic outcome. If you've got to court in a family dispute, it's usually because things have gone horribly wrong. So mediation has the enormous capacity to help people avoid that. But what's a win in mediation? What does it look like? What's a happy outcome? It's where often two people are desperately furious with one another. And let's say, for example, it's about money, or it appears to be about money. Usually it's not about the money. Of course, ultimately, somebody has been wronged and they'd like their money back. But that's not the driving force behind the dispute in the first place. It's the hurt feelings. It's a sense that somebody hasn't been listened to. It's the fact there hasn't been an apology. It's the fact that a person has been wronged. They want that to be acknowledged. They want to be heard by the other party or each other. And so in mediation, actually, most of the time, the primary thing to do, let's say, or the first element of it is, I'm trying to think of a way of putting this in a helpful and useful way, is doing the choreography, let's say, of creating a space where people are not forced, conscripted is a better word, to hear one another and stand with rules, listening. And often in the process of that happening, people start to unpick what the other person's really cross about. And that can be so useful in getting to the heart of the matter and finding some way of moving forward. And above all else, trying to point out to both parties what moving forward looks like. And two things. Firstly, that you can't relitigate the past. You can't change the past. So the only option for the two of you is to move forward. And how can you do that in a way that's going to be constructive and emotionally beneficial for both of you in the long run? Because you could stay here and be in a toxic rage with one another, but the only person and people that will hurt is you. And you'll end up, think about your emotions as little increments of emotional cash, you'll end up exhausted and depleted before you even get up in the morning. So how can we move forward? And the second thing is, how can we acknowledge our hurt and feel, I'm going to let go of the past? And again, we come back to that first idea, how we can consequently work out a remedy that feels like we've both got some semblance of justice at the same time as acknowledging we both have to compromise. So talked about Judge Rinder, and of course there was an element of high drama in it. But, you know, you only saw perhaps in those shows, maybe 20 minutes of a case max. Often they'd go on for an hour, sometimes two. I'd have to give full judgment. Transcripts would be available if necessary. But a win for us in that program would be, let's say we had families who had broken down over money or an issue of some, usually money. A win would be where they'd walked off and afterwards they'd say, I hear you, that word again, and let's try and find a way forward. That always felt like a positive.
Going back to that listening and that active listening.
If you want to build on your skills and get yourself on the right path to success, visit the City College Plymouth website, cityplym.ac.uk. You can hook up with courses, download information packs, guides, and much more. Or find us on social media. We're Skillfully Speaking Podcast on Instagram and Skillfully Speaking on Facebook and LinkedIn. Skillfully Speaking, where hidden skills are revealed. Now back to the conversation.
So all those things that you've just talked about, would you say that would apply to people in their own personal lives as well? Same thing?
Of course. Their personal lives, in professional lives, going for job interviews. It applies to everything, that active listening. People can tell whether you're engaged. And we're talking about emotional intelligence and privilege. And I hope we get to it. I will answer your question. But one thing I think is worth talking about, because I was mentioning earlier about those pupillage interviews, and sometimes people come in with a great deal of confidence. That doesn't necessarily mean they have the best substance. And a number of my mentorees, if not all of them, have come from backgrounds where debating wasn't taught, and from challenging situations and families where they're always the first to go to university. And I can give you countless examples of that. I don't want to embarrass them by naming them, but one extraordinary woman very recently has the most fascinating life, and she almost gave up until I saw her doing a sort of mock trial. She was fantastic. She'd been a social worker, various stages. She'd been homeless. I could just see she had the skills. But what was she perhaps missing in the interviews? I couldn't understand why it was that she was going to these pupillage interviews and they didn't see the talent that I saw in front of me and could hear. And again, I want to emphasize this. It's not about the book reading. Any fool can read a book. You should read them, but that's not the stuff. She just had that stuff we were talking about before. Judgment, emotional literacy, all the stuff. And the difference was, and this really is a thing, when people come into a space, when they're being interviewed, when they go into perhaps places where it might be an important element of the job, like you do, going into perhaps parliament or rooms where there are influential people, there's a question which happens to all of us, which is sometimes called imposter syndrome, which me, I know I sound like I've born with a silver spoon in my mouth, but I grew up in a working class community and this voice of mine is an invention from when I was very little. Yeah, right. You get it. Very silly. And nowadays, I must emphasize, totally unnecessary, but I can't get rid of it now. There's that sense in which you ask yourself the question, do I belong in the room? And often we look around and think, oh God, they all feel like they belong here. And here's the important secret. They all feel the same as you do. And this is where privilege intersects. There are certain schools and places and experiences you might have in childhood where you're taught to belong in the room. You're told that's expected of you. And so when you come into my chambers or parliament or the spaces you might go into, these are people you know, or they're friends of your parents, or perhaps, you know, these are encounters that you've had in the past, and therefore it's not surprising that you're going to meet so-and-so who's a judge or so-and-so who's an MP. And so you already feel comfortable and confident. And of all of the things that I think really holds people back in those spaces, that sense of shoulders back, again, resilience, emotional intelligence, but above all, there's a secret, which isn't a secret. So if you've got something to say, if you say it with passion, if you have prepared because you know what you're talking about, you belong in the room. And that's really often the thing that holds people back. So I really must emphasize that in terms of not just emotional intelligence, but that idea that there are other people who are better than you, know more, and somehow belong, that word again, in spaces that you don't, is absolute nonsense. But your previous question...
go on.
Remind me, it was about, where were we?
Active listening, wasn't it?
Yeah, which I didn't do. See, that's a good example of not doing active listening because I answered another question.
And especially in challenging situations, isn't it? Because you can listen, and I do this myself, and you're really concentrating on listening to the person. But if the conversation is really challenging and you're active listening, what are the skills to get through that to make sure that you are listening?
Well, I mean, the most important thing is to reflect back at the person what you understood they have said, but never put words in their mouth. I mean, very unsuccessful interviewers and cross-examiners on television or in court will say things like, so what you mean is, so what you're saying is.
It's listening to understand,
well,
isn't it?
But yes, sorry, can I just be clear? Am I right that, as I understand it, is this what your point is? Do correct me if I'm wrong. Or a really useful shorthand, and I often use this, and you'll start seeing it on television, and usually in cross-examination, sometimes when I'm being tricky in cross-examination, I'll say, help me, is it this? And this is a really important thing as well. You know, it's not just belonging in rooms. This comes back, we've been meandering around different themes, and you asked me about resilience, but things come to mind as we're talking.
Yeah, which is great. Carry on.
But bear in mind and go, oh gosh. And so often we walk away from encounters, especially professional ones, thinking, I'm not sure if anybody will get the Dirty Dancing reference, but I think about it all the time, you know. I carried a watermelon. If anybody's watched Dirty Dance, they'll know what that means. But that sense in which we go, oh God, that was such a stupid point. There is no stupid point. If you are having a conversation with good intent of truly wishing to understand what the other person's saying, it's okay to get it wrong. You say, I'm sorry, is it this? And she goes, or he says, no, that's not the point. Oh, I'm so sorry. Do you help me? And that's a useful way. Acknowledging your own vulnerability, acknowledging that you might get it wrong, is not a weakness. Quite the opposite, because what happens is that the person who's speaking to you feels heard, is much more likely to trust you with what they have to say, and you're more likely to learn something from it by acknowledging that you might get it wrong. And so what if you blooming get it wrong?
Human, isn't it?
Not just human, it's that vulnerability. Of course it's human, sorry, it's obviously human. But showing that aspect, that element of your humanity, often gives you better answers. And that's a requirement of active listening.
Yeah. Rob, we've talked about privilege, and the word privilege has come up quite a lot in our conversation. Mm. We have a course called Hard Hat Ready, and it's with a major national employer called Kia. And what it does is it gives opportunity to people that aren't in employment to get a skill to get them on the ladder.
Fantastic.
To do wonderful things. Just something that I felt so privileged about was there was a Nigerian young man who had just finished a carpentry course, and he was so grateful of the opportunity that he'd been given. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, he held my hand to thank me, and he just wouldn't let me go. And what that did in my heart, the opportunity he had, he did the work, but where that was going to take him, humbling.
Privilege is an overused word nowadays, and we have to be very careful about our words, because if you overuse them, they get diluted.
Yeah.
So people stop caring about them, and they then become not just problematic, but ignorable, something to be jettisoned, to get rid of. Privilege is not a problem. It's just how we identify what that is in order best to enable everybody to do the thing we all care about, which is, I feel very strongly about this, not ensuring the equality of outcome of everybody. You can't do that, I'm afraid, because people put in different effort. People have different talents. I'll never be a great artist, sadly, or a great cook. Anybody watching me on Celebrity Bake Off will know that. But
you did it.
Yes, the cameraman who saw my showstopper is still off work because he was laughing so much. He pulled his back out when he was filming my bake in the oven. But equality of opportunity, that's the stuff. And so how do we get everybody, insofar as we can, to ideally the same start line? That's very difficult. But how do we persuade all of our neighbours, the people that we share our communities and our spaces with, to feel like they can be at that start line? Your example you just gave there, think, well, actually, I can do a course. Actually, I can find time to go to college. Actually, when I do, this is going to be that beautiful, happy outcome that you just shared with us. And so when I think about privilege, often some of the barriers or some of the problems of getting people to the start line is privilege. And there's different types. In my case, perhaps my most important privilege is I was brought up in a house where I had unconditional love with a mum, especially who wanted me to be happy and meant it. I mean, whoever you are in the world, talk about gratitude. That's perhaps the most powerful and important privilege of all. I was also brought up in a house where there was a house, which sounds obvious, but, you know, 900,000 kids tonight, as we sit here talking to each other, will go to sleep, figures from Buttle, not on a bed tonight, right? No desks, etc. Had all of that stuff. And millions of our neighbours tonight will go home to homes that are uninhabitable because of mold and because they're unsafe spaces, right? So that's a huge privilege. And you talk about gratitude, express my gratitude for that. Those are the types of things, big things that stop people getting to the start line. But there are other elements of privilege as well. I didn't go to a private school, I must emphasize, but I went to a school where high academic achievement was expected, etc., etc. All of these things are privileges. they're gifts. We can think about them in different ways. But the most important thing is, how do we find ways of ensuring that we remove those barriers, as many as possible, to help people navigate? It's a bit like the assault course, if you think about it in that way. I had fewer things that I needed to jump over, fewer challenges, let's say, in order for me to get to the starting point that I did. Less than some, more than others. What we want to do in an ideal world when it comes to education is to help people where they've got those hurdles. I keep using athletic, surprised about that, athletic metaphor. But how do we help people hold their hand and jump over them and get to the start line? And once they're there, it's for them. So your example you just gave, I mean, wonderful. Yeah, but here's the thing which you acknowledge and why I suspect you're so proud of this person is because what you did, like the teacher who affected my life so powerfully, he went, well, here's the starting line. Now it's up to you. And once you do that, and it is up to the person, and they take that opportunity, it's the most magical and wonderful thing in the world, because you realize, as a teacher or somebody that's perhaps helped them find that moment of the start line, and they get to the finish, just what a blossoming that is.
And I can still feel that feeling. Yeah. And I strive to remove barriers on a daily basis, but also have a civic responsibility in sure. education and skills yeah. to do that.
It's nothing like it, is there? I mean, recently, I wish I could say that. I'd love them to come on because their stories are more powerful than mine, I think, in an important way. But two of my mentorees have gone on to get pupillage and now are working barristers. And when both of them got their tenancy, that's like a year-long job interview and everybody votes on you. In one case, I was with Rylan in India, so very recently, in the middle of filming this quite emotional scene.
Okay.
And I got a text from this particular person that she'd got tenancy, and I went, yes! Isn't it wonderful? It's the most wonderful thing.
Yes.
But that internal yes is a one on the scale.
Yeah.
For her, it's a 10.
Yeah.
You know, the tragedy is this, that had she not been so resilient, had she not, she found me, looked for mentors and been so determined and done everything she could on her own chiefly, but also alongside other people to get out of the way of the hurdles, to get to the starting line and do all of the work and have all the passion and do everything that's required to be a barrister. It wouldn't be her loss, although it would be to an extent. The most important loss would be to the bar. In other words, to the area of law. And tragically, we lose so much talent nowadays, so much passion, so much skill, because, we want to talk about privilege, because of privilege, because it costs so much money to go to university, because people don't want to get into debt, understandably, because people feel that they won't be able to do it, because young learners especially, but others as well, are told, oh, you have to have these qualifications and you have to have a first and so, all of that stuff. In other words, the world around people tells them, you know, right back to the beginning, that this story isn't for them. And so often that's wrong. And the consequence isn't just bad for that particular person because it's not true and it means they don't fulfill their ambition, which is tragic. It means that the law, and consequently we as citizens, as communities, as society in general, lose out on some brilliant people who could change and shape the world. And that's truly tragic.
Mm. And that's why further education colleges that are anchor institution for skills are just so important.
I went to an FE college.
So important.
And Amazing. That's where I met my teacher.
So your teacher was from a further education
college? Absolutely, yeah. Woodhouse Sixth Form College.
That is amazing.
They just became further education colleges at that point. Last century. But yeah, absolutely.
And everybody needs a coach and a mentor, don't they? Mentors are really important.
And to engage in lifelong learning.
Yeah.
I ended up being a broadcaster in my late 30s and I'd led teams in international cases in some challenging parts of the world. I didn't know how to broadcast. I learned and met some fantastic mentors. Now, at that point, I already had a platform and had some skills, let's say, that were transferable into that world and into that work. But that's just one example. There are so many more of people in their 50s now becoming barristers, people who are coming now making a program with a historian in the new year who was a historian and now has become a broadcaster. But what I see now, which I think is so exciting, and it's so fantastic, and so I'm so delighted to be here, is people who are realizing, and I hope people take this away, you know, that, how can we put this? The timetable for life has shifted really considerably. So, you know, how we, and when rather, we're expected to do things It's rather based on an outdated idea of how long we're going to be on our shared planet, right? So it sort of makes sense to get your mind sorted out and become a barrister at the age of 21 like I was, you know, I mean, albeit things were not exactly dissimilar then, you know, if you're not going to be here for very long. But we need to get much more comfortable with patience and taking time. So important, because if we think about other countries, sometimes where I teach or, you know, have encounters with universities and professionals, you know, you meet people perhaps in Germany and various other places. And now even in chambers, we're finding this. People will perhaps leave education for a while, go and explore life, come back to it, take 2 years out, but not out, thinking about how they might get work experience. There isn't this fixed timetable. What tends to happen, I see this a lot in young learners especially, is that they see friends, colleagues, pupils getting right ahead, going to university, getting the job. And then it's almost as if those other people are so far ahead of them that they think, well, I shouldn't bother now. And so they evaluate people, tend to do this in general, where they are by virtue of where other people are on their life's journey. And that's immaterial, because life is a marathon, not a 100-meter sprint. And so just remembering that, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are. If you're 50 today, right, you're bearing in mind how pensions are going, and you don't retire as a judge, right, until you're 72. And even then, they have you back until you're often into your 80s. You could become a barrister and have a 30-year career at 50, right? You know, at 50, you might not have all of the academic qualifications, but think about your life experience and your lived experience as we have come to understand it, and how that might inform and shape a family case, for instance. All of the common sense that you've learnt and picked up, all of the examples you'd be able to give, how by bringing up children as a mum, you want to talk about skills of explaining challenging ideas in a straightforward way. Well, being a full-time mum has the most extraordinary range of skills that are transferable in that situation. Being an advocate or a teacher, again, if you've been a mum, I mean, just so many examples. Working in a client or customer-facing way, being a checkout person. I mean, think about, even come back, the emotional intelligence that you need to handle sometimes perhaps a challenging customer. Well, that's just the same as you sitting down in the sales with somebody, albeit the stakes are slightly different.
It's wisdom, isn't it? And going back to those essential skills. Right. And you're never too old to do anything.
The most common thing I experience, and I suspect you do too, and a lot of the teachers in the college and people who come to the college will hear is, oh, I couldn't do that. Or I don't think I'd be good enough. Now, sometimes I'll meet people and I think, have you thought of being a magistrate, for example? Over 90% of criminal law is dealt with in the magistrate's court, and lots of family law, the overwhelming majority. People aren't legally qualified. You can just apply. And what do you need? And these are judges, by the way, that govern nearly all of the cases that affect all of us.
Yeah.
You need common sense and good judgment and fairness. And people say, oh, I can't do that because, you know, I haven't got this qualification. Have you got good judgment? Are you able to be impartial and fair? And can you apply your mind in a critical way? And most of the time people can, but it's that inner thing. That's, I'm touching my stomach. I'm going, oh, I could never do that. And again, I mean, I don't think a very good, although people like my books, I'm not a great writer, but the best memoirs and the best literature is usually, if not always, written by people who, when they first started writing, thought, I can't write.
I've heard that before. Rob, you've been a real strong advocate for LGBTQ rights. What role do communication and interpersonal skills play in promoting inclusivity?
Again, we come back to how we communicate. You know, a lot of the time we communicate with people who already agree with us. And so as a member of the LGBTQ plus community, let's say, I'm not one thing any more than anybody else on that buffet of various letters is one thing. You know, that's one aspect of our identity, which there's a whole colourful rainbow of different things. It's how we communicate, to be sure, but remembering that often we're a little bit fearful of communicating outside of our own comfort zone and safety of a community of people who already agree with us. Now, the good news is, and it's really important to remember this, you want to talk about gratitude. I feel quite strongly that our communities need to be very grateful of heroes of mine, people like Peter Tatchell and mentors of mine at the bar, who have made really essential and critical strides and steps forward. You know, when I was coming out, you know, shame was at the epicenter of the national conversation and the community conversation around being gay. And that had a huge impact on everything. There were laws in place. You couldn't get married. You couldn't talk about being gay in school, as you'll be aware. Now, that has changed and gone. And we do have equality in marriage and in the workplace as well. They are protected classes. Now, that's really important to remember. And that took muscle and it took activism and it took people being Dafka, being contrarian, to fight that cause. And above all else, to persuade their fellow citizens of that. That this was self-evidently the right progress and the right step forward and the right side of history. And we can't learn how to communicate or be advocates for the LGBTQ plus community without acknowledging that that progress took thoughtful activism, it took time, and it didn't take shouting, or did sometimes, didn't take the type of activism which immediately discounts those opinions whom people who disagree with us, or calling names, or screaming and shouting without also doing listening. It requires, again, we come back to the three of us, I hear you. And that hearing, in nearly all cases where somebody might have a prejudice they've formed, acknowledging that's usually out of fear, I hear you. I feel like you're being fearful, and I can understand why, because it must be this. Here are some facts. Well, there are countless facts, but let me tell you a story again. So how we best communicate, which was, I suppose, a central theme of your question, is deploying and using the same skills that we do when we communicate any idea, but remembering that being angry never persuades anybody. Often it does the precise opposite. And that even when we feel unsafe, actually we could have that, we do have this limitless capacity to help people walk away thinking, goodness me, I'm not sure about this. And that's a starting point for change. Change doesn't happen overnight. The light of justice, it takes a while to change and shift. And you see, that's a Barack Obama quote that I failed to get right. But nevertheless, it does. It's very, very slow, but it does go in the right direction. As long as you believe that you have the power to change it and you deploy and use the skills to do so. But I do worry sometimes that some of the activism, albeit with good intention, isn't necessarily used in the most effective way it can be.
How do you use your platform to challenge stereotypes?
Well, let me give you an example. It's not necessarily in the LGBTQ space, but I represented gang members for a long period of time and represented people who were accused of some of the worst crimes imaginable. And, you know, I present Good Morning Britain on a Friday, usually. Or often. I often have people come in, usually when they're doing the news review and that sort of thing, and often when they're from newspapers, perhaps with a certain leaning, and they'll say, well, young men are like this, or gang members are this. And they haven't got a clue, because they've never met a gang member. They don't know about the series of events, some chosen to be sure, don't deprive people of their agency, mostly not, of why and how that person's, young person's life journey is ended up in that situation. They don't know about that person's talent. They don't know why it is when you're born into a certain community, simply by virtue of your postcode, you might have found yourself where you are. They don't know about the range of gifts that this person has. They know nothing. So how do I challenge stereotypes? It's by empowering or enabling or using my experience to help a person who might have a really strong prejudice meet and encounter the people that they're talking about. And in nearly all cases, that radically shapes and changes people's minds. People have very strong views about prisoners and those who are serving custodial sentences until they do the thing. They go to a prison and they realize just how much neurodivergence there is there. Well, poor levels of literacy, how much abuse. Well, the range and depth of mental health issues there are in prisons. When people have that encounter, do you think that they walk out of that space saying prison is easy or prison is the answer in most cases? They're nearly always shaped and changed. So challenging stereotypes has a very easy response. It's just by meeting people and acknowledging the humanity in the other person, you're realizing, gosh, a stereotype exists. There might be some element of silly truth in it, but in nearly all cases, a stereotype has evolved because I've forgotten the one immutable fundamental thing. You're a human being. And once you've met somebody, that's the thing.
and more active listening. So you do such a plethora of things and such a wide range of things. How do you look after your own health and well-being?
Mixed. So physically, it's good. I do good physical things. The mental stuff, I'm probably less good at. So physically, I go to the gym every day. And that's not about getting muscly or anything of that kind. It's about the endorphin thwack you get at the end, a little bit of serotonin, a little microdosing of serotonin. So cold swimming too, heaven. I mean, I can't recommend it more highly. You know, guaranteed, get out of that water feeling more positive about the day. But the gym is also about doing something which I think is important. So much of our lives are ephemeral. In other words, they don't really have a beginning and end. You know, we talk about skills. Well, learning is a lifelong mission, right? It's not like you've got to ever, I've learned everything there is to know about that. You know, that's the most wonderful thing about learning is it's a bottomless well of delight. You know, I'm constantly reading about cases or about history or about art. Oh, gosh, isn't that fantastic? But it's very rare that we ever cross anything off in our day. So for me, the physical stuff of going to the gym is I can go, right, there's one thing I can cross off. That's sacred hour.
Yeah.
Done. Ticked.
Done. Tick.
Right. You tick off a shopping list. You're like, yes. And that actually feels good, right?
It does.
So
it
that's
does.
The stuff that I chiefly yeah. do that assists, let's say, my mental health. In terms of mental health, you know, I know that there have been other people who've sat in this chair that have told you about the sacred nature of sleep. I'm very bad at that. So I sleep very little and I do need to get better. And I do try and be mindful, but really it's the physical things that I do which are most influential on my mental health. Otherwise, I'm probably quite bad.
What do you eat?
No, but this is a really good question, actually. You know, you can't outrun a terrible diet. And actually, so as we're sitting here, I'm in the theatre doing Panto. It's lovely. And thank you, everybody, for coming. And I do it because, I mean, obviously, it's fun. But also, I don't do Christmas, I'm Jewish, so I do Hanukkah. And so it's 1 month a year. And obviously, I can make any unserious things. My friends say I make any unserious things serious. And, you know, I could be quite boring and rather earnest, to say the least. Sanctimonious, some might say. But I don't know what the data is, but it's pretty high. Something like 90% of people their only encounter with theatre will be Panto. And it's in nearly all cases people's first experience with theatre who go on to have theatre careers. My childhood was Panto, the only thing we really went to see. And in the cases that I used to do, often with really toxic and very difficult, challenging family situations, you would find that people would give statements saying the only time a family was happy was in Panto. So every time we go on stage, I really think it's really important and I do love it. But one of the consequences is that I find myself eating rubbish. So my mum, I don't know how she got wind of it, because it's not like we speak every day, but yesterday I think she sent me a large hint. She sent me a huge basket of fruit to the theatre.
How thoughtful.
But I know, but I find I finish the show.
Yeah.
And oh God, I'm starving. Last night I ordered a hot dog and melted cheese. It was very nice.
Yeah. So is the fruit basket still there?
No, I shared it with the car. Sorry, mum.
Rob Rinder, it has been an absolute delight to talk to you today.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck with everybody, anybody that's considering going back to skills. And I really do hope that you take away, you know, it's become such a cliche. And so I think it doesn't really pierce people's bodies and minds to remember there's no such thing as too old. There's no such thing as not good enough. As long as you're emotionally and spiritually and intellectually curious, you can do it.
Thank you, Rob, so much.
Thank
it's been
you.
A pleasure.
And thank you, lovely Plymouth.
Skillfully Speaking is supported by Babcock International. Visit babcockinternational.com. Presented by Jackie Grubb. Produced by Paul Philpott. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess-Moon. Video content by Mark Stevenson. Coordinated by Louise Greenleaf. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Copyright City College Plymouth, all rights reserved.